Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 199. My name is John. All the promises you fed to me, I'm now choking from their taste of cruelty. Did you know that as far back as the 1500s, some people believed that lemmings were spontaneously generated? They just appeared, quite literally, from the clouds. A Bavarian geographer named Jacob Ziegler described lemmings falling from the sky in stormy weather, which coincided with that era's belief that life could arise from non-living matter. Now, that, of course, was easily debunked in subsequent generations. However, you're probably much more familiar with another lemming myth. Due to a periodic population boom, lemmings were often quite abundant, and people witnessed them in mass migration. These movements can look dramatic, hundreds or thousands moving across the landscape, swimming across rivers and lakes, and some inevitably drown when they hit wide, cold, or rough water, or get swept away, or maybe they're already weakened and simply can't make it across, and they die. Early observers, travelers, farmers, naturalists, witnessed these events, saw dead lemmings in the water or washed up on shores, and interpreted them through the lens of limited knowledge. Over time, this turned into stories of vast armies marching purposefully to the sea to die. The drama was irresistible, so the accounts grew more vivid and anthropomorphic, lemmings following an instinctive death drive. In 1877, a man named W. Dupa Crotch, yeah, that was his name, published a magazine article describing watching lemmings march relentlessly westward, swimming across lakes and rivers, and ultimately plunging into the Atlantic Ocean to perish with their faces still pointing westward. Now, this was not the first published account of such behavior, but it was one of the biggest writings perpetuating the myth. In 1891, 14 years later, Crotch addressed selective interpretation errors in his earlier article. By the late 19th century and early 20th, skepticism grew, and scientists with better field studies debunked the notion of mass lemming suicide. They experience population booms every 3 to 4 years, and they need to spread out and find new territory, just like any other animal. They can swim, and sometimes they drown while crossing large bodies of water, but there's no instinctive suicide drive. They don't blindly follow each other to their death, and if a lemming drowns, it's by accident. That part was pure myth. Lemmings don't do that. They never have. However, in 1958, Disney released a nature documentary titled White Wilderness as part of their True Life Adventure series. This film is the main reason most people who grew up from the late 50s all the way to the early 90s believe that lemmings commit mass suicide, because it showed footage of lemmings running en masse to their death into the ocean and seemingly confirming folklore that dated back centuries. But wait, what about the decades of scientific studies that debunk the myth already? If it's not true, then how did this Disney-funded documentary find those iconic scenes of lemmings plunging to their deaths? They faked it. The crew brought lemmings from local kids in Manitoba and shipped them to Alberta, a place with no ocean, but hopefully soon to be its own sovereign nation, and they staged the entire sequence. They used rotating turntables covered in snow to make the animals look like they were frantically migrating. Then they herded them, chased them, and in some cases physically pushed them off a cliff into the Bow River, with tight camera angles during filming and deceptive editing in post, to create the illusion of a massive horde. The man that seems to be most directly responsible for staging the lemming sequence was wildlife photographer James R. Simon. According to the Walt Disney Family Museum, he did this without Walt Disney's knowledge or approval. The film itself was directed by James Algar, produced under Walt Disney's watch, and it even went on to win an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. The deception stayed hidden for about 25 years. It wasn't until 1983 that the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation show The Fifth Estate aired an investigation called Cruel Camera. They exposed exactly how the scenes were faked, including the fact that the same group of imported lemmings was used over and over. Disney has never made any kind of formal apology or public admission, though their historians now openly acknowledge that, yes, it did happen. As I mentioned earlier, it seems like Simon was the one responsible, but you can't be 100% sure because the people pointing the fingers have a vested interest in passing the blame somewhere else. And I can't say that I dove very deep into it, but I'm not convinced of anyone's explanation. One staged nature documentary turned an already debunked minor old folktale into something generations of people accepted as scientific fact. I remember learning that as a little kid and believing it into my early adulthood. Hell, I remember a PC game based on that entire myth back in the early 90s, where you had to save the lemmings because all that they would do otherwise is follow each other to their electronic death. It's a pretty messed up story, isn't it? One film, one devious deception, and suddenly an entire species has a reputation for dramatic self-destruction that it never deserved. Now, I want to consider this myth from three different viewpoints. First, the point of view of the documentary watcher. You think you're getting factual information from the documentary. I mean, that's what a documentary is supposed to do, present facts. Your information is only as reliable as the one providing it. In the grand scheme of things, misinformation about an Arctic rodent is probably not going to cause many problems in your day-to-day life. But the idea that media can get away with a blatant lie is something that should give us all pause. If they aren't truthful about the little things, how can we be so sure about the big things? What myths have people fervently believed, because the information providers are feeding us falsehoods. I'm talking about something that's shaped our politics more than anyone wants to admit. Lies that millions of people came to believe, not necessarily because of some grand conspiracy, although that could be what it is, but because of how the media framed stories, rushed coverage, and leaned on certain sources. I'm just going to go over two major stories from the last 25 years in the American landscape. First, the lead up to the Iraq War in 2002 and 2003. Major news outlets across the board gave extensive coverage to the Bush administration's case that Saddam Hussein's regime had active stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons. They were rebuilding its nuclear program and could even pass those capabilities to terrorists. You had high-profile moments like Colin Powell's presentation at the United Nations, which was reported as laying out a credible, intelligence-backed threat. Skeptical voices from UN inspectors or dissenting analysts didn't always get equal airtime. In the post-9/11 environment, this coverage helped build strong public support for the invasion in March 2003. I was still a conservative at the time, so I admit I was completely buying into Powell's speech. But after the war, the Iraq Survey Group, teams of experts scouring the country, found no significant WMD stockpiles or active production programs. It turns out that much of the intelligence was outdated, based on assumptions that lack of proof of destruction was equal to and meant that weapons still existed, and also relied on questionable defector claims. Later reviews pointed to intelligence failures, amplified by the media's tendency to accept the prevailing narrative from official sources. The story shifted to accountability, but the initial coverage had already shaped a generation's view of the war's justification. Fast forward to 2020 for another example. In the final weeks before the presidential election, the New York Post published stories based on emails from a laptop that Hunter Biden had left at a repair shop. The content raised serious questions about his foreign business dealings and potential involvement of his father, then Vice President Joe Biden. But the response from much of the media and tech platforms was swiftly dismissive. Outlets suggested it smelled like Russian disinformation. 51 former intelligence officials signed a public letter saying that the story had all the classic earmarks of a Russian information operation. Social media, coaxed by certain factions in the government, limited sharing, and the narrative took hold that this was likely foreign meddling rather than legitimate reporting. Years later, the FBI confirmed the laptop's authenticity in court. No evidence of tampering. Major outlets that had been skeptical eventually authenticated key documents. No solid proof emerged that the core material was fabricated by Russia. The episode highlighted how partisan timing, anonymous sourcing, and institutional bias can suppress a story, influencing what voters heard right before an election. Now, these aren't isolated mistakes. In both cases, initial coverage aligned with certain pressures. Fear after 9/11 for Iraq, intense polarization in 2020 for the presidential campaign. And this created narratives that stuck even as evidence emerged otherwise. Lesson? Healthy skepticism of any single source, waiting for fuller context, and prioritizing primary evidence over the loudest headlines. Media outlets are run by humans with deadlines and incentives, and sometimes they get it wrong in ways that ripple through society. But sometimes they also blatantly falsify reports to support their political affiliation. So to be fair, it's important to keep in mind that media outlets make mistakes. Some may be innocent, but we must never blindly trust. This is why I love the community notes on X. Sometimes I see something that just fits right into my natural distrust of government, so I hit the like button. But later on, I find out it's wrong. On the plus side, though, I've learned something. That being said, it may be simple mistakes. It may be a vast conspiracy, or anything in between. But skepticism needs to become our default setting. Why? I asked Grok to give me a rough estimation. Publicly challenged national stories, those drawing significant scrutiny, fact checks, or corrections from major U.S. outlets like New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, Fox, and so forth, would be in the range of several thousand to low tens of thousands. And that's only over the last 25 years. Now, if you're talking just in the past quarter of a century, potentially tens of thousands of stories where mistakes were made and drew significant scrutiny, you gotta be skeptical of the sources, no matter how reliable you think they may be. Media outlets are made up of fallible people operating under tight deadlines, competitive pressures, and ideological leanings. Honest mistakes happen all the time. Incomplete information, bad sources, or honest misinterpretations. But when patterns emerge, rushing narratives that fit a preferred story, slow-walking corrections, or amplifying unverified claims, that just erodes trust. Skepticism isn't cynicism per se. It's responsible citizenship. Cross-check primary sources. Look at multiple outlets, including those you disagree with, and pay attention to what gets memory-holed versus what gets hammered. Now, let me change over and imagine the perspective of the lemmings themselves, the unwitting stars of the 1958 Disney documentary. Picture this. You're a small, furry rodent in the Arctic tundra. You have a lifespan of 2 years, if you're lucky, and probably only half that, thanks to predators. You're just trying to survive, migrate, and find food like your instincts tell you to do. Suddenly, humans capture you and dozens more of your kind. They truck you off to some filming location far from your natural paths, and they turn you into props. The crew herds you with barriers, snowplows, and noise, pushing the group towards a riverbank that they've chosen for dramatic effect. You scramble, confused, following the only paths open to you that seem like freedom. You tumble into the water. The cameras roll. Narration later declares it's a suicidal death march driven by instinct. You weren't blindly following your fellow lemmings to doom. You were manipulated, funneled, stressed, and exploited by outsiders with an agenda. To create compelling footage that fit a story about nature's cruelty and crowd madness. The real Lemming Suicide was manufactured for audience entertainment and myth-making. Those lemmings didn't choose to fall into the water. They were pushed there. What forces are at work today corralling you and forcing you on a path? Now, let me start with some of the more extreme examples of people being driven off the proverbial cliff. First, one of the darkest chapters in modern history, Cambodia, under the Khmer Rouge in the late 1970s. After seizing power in 1975, Pol Pot and his radical communist regime declared Year Zero. And to me, that just sounds like some modern comic book storyline. But then it meant a total reset of society. They evacuated entire cities at gunpoint, abolished money, private property, schools, and religion. Millions of Cambodians, doctors, teachers, engineers, anyone with an education or glasses, were marched into the countryside to work in forced agrarian communes. The goal? Well, Pol Pot and his regime wanted to create a pure, classless agrarian utopia overnight. The leadership told the people that this was liberation from Western corruption and the old order. Propaganda praised the revolution. Dissent, or even suspected intellectualism, meant execution in the infamous killing fields. The results were catastrophic. In less than 4 years, roughly 1.5 to 2 million people, about a quarter of Cambodia's total population, died from starvation, disease, overwork, and mass executions. Families were torn apart. Society was gutted. The Khmer Rouge didn't just lead people off that proverbial cliff. They dismantled the entire mountain and forced everyone to rebuild it with their bare hands according to a communist's impossible blueprint. Like the lemmings herded and forced to the cliff, this was rounding up citizens and forcing them to the manufacturing of the communist utopia lie. It was ideology, coercion, and propaganda turning citizens into instruments of their own destruction. Either do the bidding of the regime or die. And even if you do what you're told, any number of things could result in a bullet in your head. And as atrocious as that was, China, under Mao Zedong, offers back-to-back brutal masterclasses in state-led catastrophe. The Great Leap Forward, late 50s to the early 60s, which I covered in a podcast a while back, but here's a quick review. Mao's communist government launched an aggressive campaign to try to industrialize China overnight and surpass the West. Farms were collectivized into giant communes. Local officials, terrified of failing quotas, inflated harvest numbers while seizing grain for export. Backyard steel furnaces provided by the government produced useless metal. But anyone questioning the plan risked being labeled as a counter-revolutionary. The human cost was staggering. Famine on a scale almost unimaginable, with death toll estimates ranging from 20 to 45 million people. Villages emptied. Parents watched children starve, all while the regime claimed record progress. Then, just a few years later, in the late 60s into the 70s, came the Cultural Revolution. Mao, once again, fearing losing control, unleashed students and the masses as Red Guards to attack capitalist rotors, intellectuals, and traditional culture. Schools shut down. Teachers and officials were publicly humiliated, beaten, and/or killed. Ancient artifacts and temples were destroyed. Chaos reigned as faction fought faction. Millions more suffered, hundreds of thousands to several million dead, with a whole generation's education and economy devastated. Families turned on each other at the behest of their leader. The country was convulsed for a decade. In both of these cases under Mao, the Chinese people weren't leaping off the cliff out of animal instinct. They were mobilized, propagandized, and often terrorized into following top-down visions that ignored reality, economics, and basic humanity. The leadership set the course. The citizens paid the price. And I hope you noticed in these examples of Cambodia and China some similarities to what communists and socialists are attempting to implement in America. Ironically, it wasn't until China began to incorporate aspects of capitalism into their country that they were able to build to the burgeoning world power that they are today. But come on, those are examples of governments on the other side of the world. We're not being manipulated like that today in our government, right? Oh, you see, the examples that I just gave you are how it ends. What we're seeing in America today is how it begins. They're closing us in and guiding us to the cliff. Now let's talk about something that hits close to home. Literally, building or buying a house has gotten dramatically harder and more expensive for many Americans, thanks in part to layers of federal regulation. A key culprit is the National Environmental Policy Act, signed in 1970. And the original goal was reasonable: require federal agencies to assess environmental impacts of major projects. But through decades of court decisions and agency expansions, it now applies to a vast array of private housing developments that need any federal permit or funding. Developers face years of environmental impact statements, public comment periods, and litigation. A study by the National Association of Home Builders found that regulatory cost can add tens of thousands of dollars per home. This reduces housing supply, especially in high-demand areas, driving up prices and rents. First-time buyers and low-income families get squeezed out. When affordability becomes a crisis, politicians respond with more federal and state interventions, expanded subsidies, inclusionary zoning mandates, rent controls, or new environmental rules. These often discourage new construction further or create shortages, black markets. The cycle repeats. More rules meant to help, but frequently making the core problem worse. In healthcare, the story is similar. The Affordable Care Act of 2010, often called Obamacare, was designed to expand coverage and rein in costs. It included an individual mandate requiring most Americans to have insurance, Medicaid expansion in participating states, subsidies, and new regulations on insurers like essential health benefits and guaranteed issue. Oh, it did increase the number of insured people, because it mandated that people be insured. However, for many in the individual market, premiums rose sharply in the early years, deductibles climbed, and plan choices narrowed. Administrative burdens and provider consolidation added pressure, the cost of the extra bureaucracy. The individual mandate created legal and financial pressure to enroll, while penalties enforced it initially. Without those mechanisms, coverage gains would have been significantly smaller, according to CBO analyses. When problems persisted, rising costs, access issues, lawmakers added more layers. Enhanced subsidies, drug price negotiation rules, surprise billing protections, and countless regulations from HHS and states. Each round increases compliance costs for doctors, hospitals, and insurers, which get passed to patients or taxpayers. Innovation in care delivery sometimes slows under the weight of rules. The result is a system where more people have coverage cards, but many still struggle with affordability and access. The regulatory spiral continues without ever addressing what is driving the underlying cost, the regulations and bureaucracy itself. Even groceries in your cart aren't immune to this pattern. Federal farm policy and energy rules have distorted food markets for decades. Heavy subsidies in recurring farm bills favor large-scale production of crops like corn, soybeans, and wheat. Layered on top, the Energy Policy Act of 2005 and later expansions created the Renewable Fuel Standard, mandating ethanol, mostly corn-based, blends in gasoline. This diverted huge portions of U.S. corn crop from food to fuel. The consequences? Higher feed costs for livestock, which raised meat, dairy, and egg prices. Global food price volatility increased in some periods. Smaller farms face compliance hurdles, while big agribusiness benefits from the sports. When food prices spike, or critics highlight inefficiencies, Congress passes updated farm bills with more subsidies, crop insurance expansions, conservation rules, and nutrition program mandates. These add bureaucracy and costs that ripple through the supply chain right to consumers, without consistently lowering everyday grocery bills. The cycle entrenches government involvement rather than letting markets adjust supply more dynamically. Each time our government interferes with a market, whether it be food, medicine, housing, or anything, it only makes matters worse, but somehow makes their influence on our lives greater. And again, that's just three examples. I challenge you to find any aspect of your life where government isn't trying to force its way into more control, resulting in higher cost. And it's certainly not just the federal government. You can see the out-of-control pricing fiasco with the state of California, and the collapsing services in New York City. Interestingly, though, whatever new bureaucracy they introduce, no matter how detrimental it is, they always tout it as the best thing ever and how glorious they are to have given it to us. Meanwhile, we are being financially herded into poverty. And finally, I'm going to examine the perspective of the people who actually made the documentary, the filmmakers behind Disney's 1958 White Wilderness. The documentary creators weren't naive about lemming behavior. They just didn't care. They justify their actions with the money they made. Under pressure to deliver gripping nature footage for a major studio, the crew imported lemmings to a non-native location, used no plows and barriers to herd them, and carefully staged the dramatic plunge into the water. The result was cinematic gold, a compelling mass suicide scene that fits the narrative of instinctive herd madness. Who cares about the lemmings? They're dumb little rodents. Let them die. And Disney? Well, they've always denied any wrongdoing and placed the blame squarely on the film crew, but even the best case scenario means they were funding without any oversight. Disney and the team gained prestige, audience members, and financial success. The little lemmings were simply props, expendable tools in service of entertainment and profit. From their viewpoint, blending the truth was just show business. This mindset, prioritizing the story, the paycheck, and the impact over accuracy, helps explain how misinformation takes root. When creators don't care about the real consequences for the subjects or the public, myth becomes accepted fact, and real harm follows downstream. What kind of company just takes what is given to them as gospel without checking the fact for themselves? Well, pretty much every news service in existence these days. One of them gets a report about the number of plastic straws that are thrown away, and like dominoes, the next outlet sees it and runs the same report, and on down the line. Then you find out the report was based on a 9-year-old child's school project based on estimations he got from cold-calling straw manufacturers. A more striking case of a major media outlet running with information that they had reason to doubt, or outright knew had problems, came in 2014 with Rolling Stone magazine. The article titled, "A Rape on Campus," told a horrifying story of a gang rape at a University of Virginia fraternity party. It relied almost entirely on one anonymous source named Jackie and painted the university as callously indifferent. The piece exploded online, sparked national outrage, won awards consideration, and fit perfectly into the broader conversations about campus sexual assault. But there were major red flags during the reporting process. Fact checkers and editors had concerns. Contradictory details emerged. The fraternity was never contacted for comment. Still, the story ran. Later investigations, including one by the Columbia Journalism School at Rolling Stone's own request, revealed the account had serious fabrications and couldn't be corroborated. The magazine fully retracted the story. The fraternity sued and won a defamation settlement. Turned out the narrative had been rushed because it was too good a story to check thoroughly. This wasn't just sloppy journalism. It showed how the desire for impact, clicks, and cultural relevance can lead an outlet to push a story despite knowing the foundations were shaky at best. The damage to the accused, the university, and public trust was real and lasting. It's all about greed, manipulating people, putting the money and notoriety before the truth. And it certainly isn't just the media doing it. Corporate tycoons have sometimes built or expanded fortunes by peddling misleading narratives. A prime example is the Sackler family behind Purdue Pharma. They aggressively marketed OxyContin while downplaying addiction risks, contributing to the opioid epidemic. Billions flowed in before major lawsuits and bankruptcy exposed the practices. The corporation and the government failed as the FDA approved the drug and faced heavy criticism for approving it with labeling that downplayed addiction risks and for slow response to abuse signals. And of course, we all know about the long history of tobacco marketing and how industry executives like those at Philip Morris spent decades promoting doubt about smoking's health risks despite internal evidence, amassing enormous wealth before massive settlements. Politicians have also gained power and wealth by spreading or amplifying questionable claims. Take Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, and early promotions of the Green New Deal. Oversimplified timelines and economic claims helped build her national brand, leading to book deals, high speaking fees, and massive fundraising, even as critics and fact-checkers highlighted practical shortcomings. And on the other side of the aisle, whether you support Donald Trump or not, by repeatedly claiming the 2020 election was stolen, he was boosting what was at the time his post-presidency media deals, merchandise, and political fundraising. And yeah, I'm fully aware of similar tactics from supporters of the 2016 Hillary and 2024 Harris campaigns. Politicians on both sides have also exaggerated border or crime statistics during campaigns to drive donations and voter turnout, turning complex issues into profitable fear narratives. And let's be honest, if I tried to list all the bullshit narratives from our government, I could have podcasts through the quincentennial. Entertainers and media personalities have turned misinformation into lucrative empires. Filmmaker Michael Moore has profited handsomely from documentaries that critics argue selectively edit facts or push misleading narratives on topics like capitalism and guns. Certain reality TV stars and podcasters have monetized health or political misinformation through sponsorships and paid subscriptions, even after public corrections. And of course, there's a loud group that blame all of that on capitalism. But that, again, is just narrative misrepresentation. It's not capitalism. It's really just greed. You see, capitalism, true capitalism, is mutually agreeable trade. That means a capitalist's incentive is to provide a service that will either bring you back for more or inspire you to send others to partake of their service. That's the difference between the collectivists and the capitalists. Well, one of the differences at least. The ruling class of the collective, they just want to manipulate you into serving their desires, and they don't care what happens to you in the process. You could die. It doesn't matter. The capitalist may get something from you, but only with your consent and with pre-agreed trade and compensation. Anti-capitalist claims are among the biggest false information narratives today. Whether it's a heartless documentary maker, a Hollywood darling, a monstrous communist regime, or just your average American politician, they will sell you any lie they can without any remorse. To them, you're lemmings. Just something to be corralled, guided, used, and discarded. In the end, whether it's lemmings herded off a riverbank for dramatic footage, a libelous Rolling Stone story rushed to print despite red flags, or federal policies layering regulation on regulation while costs keep climbing, the pattern's the same. We're beset by those with incentives to misconstrue, sensationalize, and control the narrative. The little lemmings didn't choose the plunge, but the documentary makers got their shot. And us little citizens are forced to follow flawed government plans and then get stuck with the bill, paying the price in ruined lives and wasted resources. And despite all that, I want you to understand, the takeaway isn't cynicism. It's vigilance. Question the scary headline, the urgent policy fix, and the herd rushing toward the next solution. Seek primary sources. Demand evidence over emotion. Question the herd even when you're told not to question. Hell, especially when you're told not to question. And remember that truth can be concealed with a simple change of camera angle. When we stop letting the would-be controllers get away with it, we break the cycle. Lemmings, in reality, don't blindly follow. And we shouldn't either. Especially when the end result is death. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.